This is the 2009 Central Saskatchewan Study Weekend with Brother Jim Cowie. His overall theme is the King's Manifesto for Life. This is Class 3, entitled, You Are the Light of the World. And the reading was from Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 26.
Thanks once again, Brother Andrew. Well, brethren and sisters and young people, this is the so-called graveyard session. After having eaten well, it's very difficult to remain awake. But we have before us some challenging things, so hopefully you will remain attentive as we endeavour to unravel the teachings of our Lord. Teach me thy way, we sang. And that's exactly what this is about, learning his way. I want to just summarise what we've done in our previous sessions, particularly in the last one, by the words again of Brother Sargent. You'll see two or three of these in this session as well. He's talking about the foundation of the kingdom. He says, and behind this teaching on the way of life is the fact that the pattern character which he paints is his own. It must be so, for he is the king, the anointed of the Lord. And from him the kingdom must take its character and its law. By him, the ground of citizenship must be defined. He's done that. In the eight blessings, we have seen the presentation of a portrait of a citizen of Zion. That's the character that will see us attain the kingdom. Now, of course, we're not going to be perfect in that. We know that only too well. But providing there is in us, brethren and sisters, a reflection of the Father's character, he will not reject us. We are told in 1 Peter chapter 1 that the one thing that cannot be destroyed, that is everlasting, is the word of our God. And if that word has formed in us a likeness to himself, at least in some degree, he will not destroy it. He will not reject it. So we have hope. We can be forgiven for our failings, for our deficiencies and inadequacies. But we do need to build. We need to build that character. And that character also needs to be revealed in our behaviour every day. This is what is before us in this session, the manifestation of the Christ character. That's what this section is about. In verses 13 to 16, we have the revealing of the Christ character and hence our relationship with the world, who should see that in us. Then he turns to the new law in operation. Verses 17 to 20, the new and the old law are compared, and we're going to see that he goes above and beyond the old. He demonstrates that true righteousness, not like that of the scribes and Pharisees, true righteousness must abound. And then he's going to start to deal with the law of the heart. He's going to dig into our motivation in life. Verses 21 to 24, he deals with hatred in the heart. And in 25 and 26, humility when in error. The process of judgment and mercy, the principle of peacemaking, as we're going to see in due course. Let us again use the words of Brother Sargent to set our course. Jesus, he says, has pictured for the disciples the character which has its foundation in faith in God as Father and in a clear conviction in his kingdom and his righteousness. This character is revealed in the very conditions of evil which exist in the interim before the kingdom is established. In those conditions, the character must retain its unfailing savour, which belongs to the covenant with God. Its unfailing savour. You know what they used to do with salt that had lost its savour? In the times of our Lord Jesus Christ, they would spread it on the roads to be trodden underfoot of men. I used to use it on the ascent to the altar as well. So it was trodden underfoot of men. There needs to be in us, brethren and sisters, an unfailing savour. So if you have this character and it's being developed in your life, it is something that belongs to you. It is growing. It's not something you do today and not tomorrow. This is about you developing to be like the Son of God and therefore like the Father. It has to be an unfailing savour. So what is this salt that he's talking about? Verse 13, ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savour, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out and to be trodden under foot of men. Now salt, especially in a warm climate like the one that I come from, is a very necessary part of life, even in a cold climate. I happen to have noticed as I pass by blocks of salt out in the fields, which I presume are there for winter time so that your cattle can lick the block of salt. Is that what happens in the winter time? So even in a cold climate, salt is essential for life. It's certainly essential in a warm climate. And in the scripture, in Job 6, verse 6, it was used in the preparation of food. In Isaiah 30, verse 24, we read of it used in animal fodder. And it had two main uses. It was a preservative. You might say that this is an aspect that could be classified as negative. It stops corruption. It arrests decomposition. So it's used in food, you salt fish, etc., to preserve it from corruption. But it's also used as a condiment. That's why it's on the table. You sprinkle it on your food. It gives zest and flavour to food. Is that not true? So there's a negative and there's a positive aspect to salt. It arrests corruption. It gives zest and flavour. That is what the Christ character is about. He's not talking here about anything else but what he's already said. This Christ character, the eight blessings, the eight principles woven into the life, is what he's talking about. He said that has two results. Preserves from corruption, and it gives zest. And there's nothing better, in my view, than to see the character of God revealed in people. I find that very, very tasteful, don't you? There's a zest about that. There's something extremely interesting about that. But what if the salt loses its savour? Well, then, of course, it's good for nothing. Salt is also a symbol for faithfulness in the Word of God. In the references there, Numbers 18, verse 19, 2 Chronicles 13, verse 5, Leviticus 2, verse 13, there is reference in the text to a covenant of salt. God made with certain a covenant of salt. In other words, it's talking about his faithfulness to his promises. He promised something, it is sure to be fulfilled. So salt is used in that relationship. And then, of course, in places like Mark chapter 9, 49 and 50, it's used of purity and zest. It just so happens, brethren and sisters, that this word salt occurs eight times in the New Testament. And eight is our number of immortality, isn't it? There were eight blessings, eight parts to the character. And God uses the term salt in the New Testament eight times. So it stands, as we say here, in this context, for the savour and strength of the Christ character revealed in the so-called Beatitudes. Brethren and sisters, let me just say something before I forget it. The next verse, verse 14, says this, ye are the light of the world. And sometimes we hear that this is about going out and preaching the gospel. Now we have an obligation, unquestionably, to preach the gospel. We need to teach as many as we can about the things of the truth that have entered into our lives. But let's be clear, Christ is not talking here about preaching the gospel. He is talking about manifesting the character of verses 1 to 12. That's what he means by salt. That's what he means by light. Ye are the light of the world. This is about living the truth, not just speaking it. Okay? We need to be very clear about that. Brother Sargent again, page 81 this time of the teaching of the Master on the salt of the earth. To the man of the world, meekness, poorness of spirit, and the rest are the insipid virtues of the feeble and undervitalized, the inferior. They are the mark of the slave morality. To Jesus, exactly the reverse is true. The men of God are not insipid, but salty. It is they who have savour and strength of character. How true that observation is. The world looks at us and they think we're insipid. What a wasted life that is. Insipid. But in actual fact, if you have the Christ character, then you are very salty, providing it hasn't lost its savour. And what happens when you rub salt into wounds? Now, it's a good thing, isn't it? You have a wound to rub salt into, or at least to go into the salt water. Now, there might not be too much salt water around here. I've seen a lot of fresh water. But where we live, we're only a few minutes away from salt water. And we tell our kids, you can cut your feet or whatever, go and walk in the salt water. It's good. It will get rid of the infection, etc. Well, you see, rubbing salt into wounds hurts. It stings open wounds like leprosy. Look at that poor creature there. This, if you can see that, this dreadful leprous face and this leprosy on the hand. Guess what happens when you rub salt into that? What's that telling us? Well, it's telling us this. This is the principle that we saw when he said, "Blessed are ye when ye are persecuted for righteousness' sake." Flesh will react and fight back. You see? If you present this character to people and you are consistent and you have savour, they're not going to enjoy that experience, many of them, because you are a testimony against their evil ways. And they don't like having you there demonstrating what they should be. So it's like rubbing salt into wounds, leprous wounds, because that's, of course, a symbol for the activity of sin in human life. Again, Brother Sargent says this, when human pride brings rivalry among the disciples, he can tell them to have salt in themselves and have peace with one another. The salt of humility gives the savour of peace. But this potent quality of life does not belong to men by nature. How is it attained? Only by the self-discipline, which is self-sacrifice. It's the opposite to the natural way of man. And then we come to verse 14. He says, ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. House of Israel, he means. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works. You'll notice he doesn't say, let your speech be heard by men, that they might hear your words. He's talking about character being manifested, a way of life, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven, because in actual fact you are demonstrating that you are his children. That's why he says, your Father. Now that's pretty simple, isn't it? But brethren and sisters, this is an enormous responsibility, because it means that when we go out into the world, the cosmos, that's the word used here, into this order of things, men should see in us this character of the Father revealed. Now I know, and you know, that we all fall far short of what we would like to be. But we have to keep on that path. We have to try and ensure that the salt does not lose its savour, and it will if we get away from what we know develops within us a likeness to our God. Ye are the light of the world. Now, he talks about a candlestick. This is the word luknia in the Greek. It means a lampstand. It just so happens to occur 12 times in the New Testament. And of course we know the lampstand is a symbol for the ecclesia. the Israel of God. And the number of Israel? 12. Again, you see that there is this framework in which he is speaking. And we know, of course, the vision of the night vision of Zechariah in Zechariah chapter 4 presents the two olive trees feeding the seven branch lampstand. It's a figure, it's a symbol of things to come, of our involvement in the kingdom age, brethren and sisters, shining forth. Well, today we are a lampstand. We are the Israel of God in the earth. And a city set upon a hill cannot be hid, he said. Now, I think he has Jerusalem in mind. Jerusalem, even in the day, even as it is today, can only be seen when you crest the hills on the west and the east. Certainly from the north it cannot be seen until you're almost upon it. So you see, he's talking about a city set on a hill. He's saying you cannot hide that. If you are manifesting the Christ character, it can't be hidden. You will live life separate to those around you. You will not behave like them. You will behave like God. And if you do, you will stand out. You'll be like a pimple on a pumpkin, so to speak. A city on a hill. You can't hide that. You can't be a chameleon and sort of disappear. You will be seen. That's how it has to be. There's a very strong exhortation in that, isn't there? For each one of us. But we can conceal this light. Light here represents the fruits of knowledge revealed in the character portrayed in verses 1 to 12. And Christ mentions two ways in the New Testament. One of them's here in Matthew 5:15. Two ways that we can conceal that light. Here in Matthew 5:15 he says, "Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel, but on a lampstand." Now a bushel was a dry measure of capacity used for buying and selling. When you went down to the marketplace in those times, you tucked a bushel under your arm and you went down. You might have had something in it to sell. You might have been going down to buy. You'd tuck your bushel under your arm and down you go. You went to the marketplace where trading and business is done. It stands here as a representation of the interference of business and the cares of this life. That's one of the reasons I believe, brethren and sisters, that we've gone through in the last 6 or 7 or 8 months this financial crisis. It's one of the final warnings that God is giving us. It's also one of the final tests that he's giving us. Because in order to maintain our living standards that we've enjoyed in the past, some of us have had to go and find additional jobs. Or we've had to go out of our way to continue the income that we've got used to. We're not prepared to trim down. So we've got to go out of our way. And what suffers? Well, your daily Bible readings, your attendance at the ecclesial meetings, your work in the truth. There's a whole range. Your attention to your family. There's a whole range of things that can be affected, can't they? You know what Christ would call that? A bushel. A bushel. You've put the lamp under a bushel. Business has got in the way. Simple, isn't it? But there's a second thing that he says we can do with this light. In Luke chapter 8 verse 16, he says, you can hide it by putting it under a bed. Now who would foolishly light a candle or a, you know, one of those lamps that they had and stick it under a bed, put it under a mat? Ridiculous. But you see, a bed is a place for repose. It's the antithesis of the bushel. Whereas the bushel speaks about too much business activity, the bed speaks about inactivity, laziness, slothfulness, simply not being prepared to put in the effort. That's what it's talking about. So he's got the two ends of the spectrum. He's got bushel and bed, and they represent the two extremes of how we can hide the light of his character, which he is building, or at least his Father is building in us. That's his message here. It's pretty clear. It's pretty simple. It just needs us to focus and to decide whether or not there needs to be some correction. in our lives. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Now he turns to the new law in operation in verse 17. Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fulfill. There would have been some who said, I think he's pushing the law of Moses aside. And they would have been very upset with this. He said, don't you get the idea that I've come to destroy. This word destroy, kataluo, means to dissolve. Hence destroy or demolish. Don't get the idea that I've come to do that. I've come to fulfill, kleru, to make full, to fill up, to complete. And that's exactly, of course, what he did. And he goes on to say in verse 18, for verily I say unto you. Now here is the first of this phrase which is so frequently used in this discourse. I say unto you. Because you see, he is going to compare and contrast the law of Moses. He's going to show that he's gone above and beyond it. He fills it up. He shows that the law was holy, just and good, but it wasn't complete until he came along and filled it up and went beyond it. He's going to superabound. He's going to take them beyond mere law. He's going to show what a life before God must have in it. He says, not one jot or tittle will pass. See verse 18. I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, AD 70, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled. That word fulfilled there is a different word. It's genomai. It means to become. It will have done its job. And it will be, as we know, set aside because there was something superior that had been put in its place. But this term, no wise, he uses this twice. In fact, this is an emphatic negation. Now, you may be aware, in the Greek language, there are two words for no or not. One is subjective, the other one is objective. You, objective. You, it's outside of me, see? Me, this is very convenient. We've got some of this in our English language. You and me, see? You, objective. Me, subjective. And they are used separately numerous times in the New Testament. But quite often, you find them put together. Ooh, me. And what that meant to the Greek was this. Absolutely never any possibility that this will happen. No, 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 absolutely no. Can I say it more emphatically than that? Well, that's what ooh, me means. Got a picture? So he uses that word. Shall in no wise. And a little later on, he talks about people who will not be in the kingdom. He uses the same phrase, ooh, me. There's reason for that. So he comes in verse 19 to speak about abounding righteousness in contrast to the ritual of law. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So breaking, luo, loosening, unbinding, releasing from bonds. You see, there were some who said, but he's actually writing down what God said in the law. He's trying to take away from it. In fact, he was fulfilling it. It was they, the scribes and the Pharisees, whom he later on points out, were writing down God's law. I mentioned to someone earlier today about Luke chapter 16. You remember the steward who was found to be unfaithful? You know what happened to him? When he's called before his Lord, he's got to answer. But you see, what he'd been doing when he was put out of his office, he did again. He went to his Lord's servants and said, look, how much do you owe your master? How much do you owe God? 100 measures of wheat, or 100 measures of oil, 100%. You know what he said? Don't think about it. Sit down quickly and write 80, or write 50. Christ is saying, you scribes and Pharisees, this is you, unfaithful stewards. You write down God's law, and you encourage men to diminish God's requirements in their lives. He wants 100%, you say 50 or 80 will do. He didn't come to do that. He says every jot and tittle of its principles will be fulfilled and not diminished. And he says that those who do this, who break these commandments and teach men so, and there were many in Israel who did that, and many rabbis did that, will be least in the kingdom. This is his way of saying that there will be everlasting penalties applying to the diminution of God's law in practice or teaching. And then he goes on to say this, "For I say unto you," in verse 20, "that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case ooh me." Intense negation. No case enter into the kingdom of heaven. So he says, there are serious consequences to doing this, writing down the things of the law, and serious consequences of not going beyond the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Now this tends to worry us a bit, because like the people of his time, we look at these scribes and Pharisees and we say, well, they look pretty good to me. Now, like he said in Matthew 23, things that they say to you, do, but don't do after their private practices. Because they had a problem, a real problem, and we need to explore that problem, brethren and sisters, because you see, this is about righteousness of law versus the righteousness of faith. Now, divine morality and principles have never changed and never will change. The law of Moses was built around that divine morality and his principles. The law, said Paul in Romans 7, is holy, just, and good. There was nothing in it that could be in any way negative or evil. There was only one thing in it that required it to be removed, and that was, cursed is he that hangs upon a tree, which condemned our Lord. So it had to be removed, because it was not of his doing. So then, the Sadducees, the scribes, and the Pharisees, the rabbis, the lawyers, all looked upon God's law from the outside. They took the text and they examined the text and said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this. And, got an idea? It's all about externals. So they came up with all sorts of things, you know, taking a handful of grain from the field and rubbing it. To them, that was harvesting. And this was threshing. This is work. Sabbath day? Oh, no. You couldn't even crack an egg on the Sabbath day. So they'd made it into a law that had all these little details about ritual and externals. And they'd lost sight of where it was coming from. And that's what Christ is going to talk about. Now, Brother Sargent again hits the nail right on the head. He says, the Pharisee, beginning from the outside, fails to reach the core. Jesus, beginning with the innermost principle, works outwards to externals. That's the difference. Except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. So their righteousness was based upon externals. How you can put into your life all of these rituals and things that the law said you had to do, and more over and above that delivered to them by the rabbis. They work from the outside and never reach the core in their hearts. Divine morality was not written in their hearts. Divine principles were not the governing motivation. It was about being seen to do these things, the externals. The Lord comes from in here and works outwardly. If you can get the heart right, brethren and sisters, if divine principles motivate everything you do, then your actions automatically are going to be in accordance with His will. You'll get the externals right because the internals are right. Now that's pretty simple, I think, isn't it? So it's talking about what you and I have to do. We have to keep our focus here on this book so we understand, teach me thy way. And we can get the principles installed into the brain, and that's how we think. Then what we do will automatically follow. From the heart, fruits will emanate that are in accordance with the divine principle. And that's going to be a righteousness that doesn't come from us. It comes from our Father. And it will exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. Again, we see that this is what the Apostle Paul talks about when in Romans chapter 2 he talks about the Gentiles who don't have a law, he says, who do by, the word in the AV is nature, it's actually phusi in the Greek, who do by an infused disposition, a way of thinking introduced into their brains from outside, the law. And the law, he says, is written in their hearts. That's where we have to be. Brother Sargent again. It is precisely as his own spiritual sense grows that the godly man becomes more aware of the gulf between the holiness of God and the corruption of man. They cannot wish for the righteousness of God to be manifest in the earth unless they long for it to be fulfilled in themselves. This is the righteousness, the kind of righteousness that exceeds the righteousness of scribes and Pharisees. Now you see, he's raised the matter of what's going on in the human heart. He tells us that if this is not the way, then we cannot be in the kingdom. And now he's going to give some practical examples of what should be going on in the heart. He comes to verse 21. Ye have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, you see, he's going to exceed what was said in old time. And of course it was said by Moses in Exodus 20, verse 13, thou shalt not kill. It was part of the Ten Commandments. It's from God. It's holy, just and good. But it didn't go far enough. You see, that's what the Lord's saying. I say unto you. It was there for a reason. It was a temporary institution. He's going to go above and beyond it. And he says, I say unto you, verse 22, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raka, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. So there's gradation here. There's an echelon of seriousness. Now some people suggest, some commentators have suggested that the words without a cause are not in the text. I see no reason. I've found no evidence as to why we should drop those words out. Because you see, there is such a thing as righteous anger, brethren and sisters, isn't there? Paul says in Ephesians chapter 4, be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. The Lord himself was often angry with people. Angry against the Pharisees and others for their hypocrisy. So there is a time for anger. We've got to make sure that that anger is not for our sake. That it doesn't come from human pride. That it's our position that we're angry about. That the anger is actually genuinely because God's principles are in jeopardy. But that's our problem, isn't it? Our problem is to hold in anger when it's particularly about ourself. And he's talking here about personal relationships. I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Now this word angry, orgizo, means to be provoked to anger, to be angry, to be wroth. Nothing unusual about that. And then he says, whosoever shall say to his brother, raka. Raka is an Aramaic term of contempt. Actually means empty. Has the idea of calling someone senseless or empty-headed. You know, you're a vacant-headed, empty-headed idiot, you might say of someone. So you're actually speaking contemptuously about them. And you'll notice there's an order of seriousness here. In danger of the judgment, raka shall be in danger of the council. The council here is the Sanhedrin. That's the Greek word Sanhedrin. It's the great council at Jerusalem. 71 members, composed of scribes and elders and prominent members of the high priestly families. They constituted the council. It was the highest legal forum amongst the Hebrews, the Jews. But there's worse. Because you see, brethren and sisters, he talks about people who call someone a fool being in danger of hell fire. Brother Sargent chimes in. He says this, meekness is first a disposition towards God, an awe of him, which results in confident dependence on him as righteous and faithful. But humility towards God has its effect in a forgiving and self-abnegating spirit towards men. You might say to me, well, what's that about in the context? Just wait. This is critical to what the Lord is saying. Do you see, he's going to tell us now about our attitude when we may well be in the right and we are subject to this kind of speech against us. When we are the victim of this. That's what he's going to talk about. What's your attitude? Is it going to be forgiving and self-abnegating, which means putting self last? Or are you going to react like the person who is saying these sorts of things about you? So what does it mean to say thou fool? Well, this word fool is moros. We get our English word moron from that. It means dull or stupid, as if shut up. That is, heedless, morally. A blockhead. In other words, this is saying about someone that they are so useless and moronic that they can't be saved. It's actually about character assassination. It's about calling people names that really mean we think that they're so useless and worthless that they can't be in the kingdom. Now, why do I say that's that serious? Well, the following words. Shall be in danger of hell fire, Gehenna. And the valley of Hinnom, south of Jerusalem, of course, was the rubbish dump where the filth of the city, dead animals and other refuse were cast out and burned. It is used, we well know, by the Lord Jesus Christ frequently of being doomed at the judgment seat, of having no hope of salvation. So somebody who says this sort of thing, who character assassinates someone else, is doomed unless they are redeemed. So who's going to do the redeeming? Do you think this gentleman, should I use that word? Do you think this gentleman who goes around character assassinating others, does this happen? Does this happen? In my experience, it does happen in our community. That this person has actually judged themselves unworthy of the kingdom. They're doomed unless they are redeemed. And you are the offended party. You're the one about whom these things have been said. You're the victim. You have reason to be upset by this. Who's going to redeem this fellow? who's made this kind of statement. You, the offended party. One of the most difficult things we ever have to do, brethren and sisters, is to set out to redeem someone who has gone around assassinating our character. It is very, very difficult. But I'll tell you who won't do that. The gentleman who's blind to his own problem. He won't do that because he can't see. He's blind. He's not going to save himself. He's not going to take action to redeem himself. You have to take the action to redeem him, despite your injury. That's what the next verse is about. This is about humility towards God. Verse 23. Therefore, if thou bring thy gift to the altar, and there rememberest, mimnesko, to call to one's mind. It's pretty hard to forget things that are said that are very harsh, isn't it? When they hurt, and a sword has been struck through you in bitterness and hatred, envy or whatever it's coming from. It's very hard to forget that, and especially when you come to the meetings, or in their case, going to the temple, when you remember that thy brother hath aught against thee, he's been saying these things about you, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way. First, be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer thy gift. Gift, doron, a present, specifically a sacrifice. So what's he saying? Well, he's saying this in simplicity, that we simply cannot carry on our personal relationship with God while the offender who stabbed us in the back is out of harmony with God. That's what he's saying. This doesn't necessarily mean, brethren and sisters, that we don't come to the meeting on Sunday because we've yet to resolve a problem we have. What he's talking about here is a bit wiser than that. He's saying you can't go on in your personal relationship with God, which will see you, if you're consistent in the kingdom, and just leave the other chap who's in serious trouble to his own devices. That's what he's saying. You can't do that. You have to make some attempt. And I know brethren have come along and said, well, look, I've tried, I've gone to the brother, and I've followed Matthew 18, I've done all, and nothing works. Well, you've done what you could do. You've tried, and that's what you're asked to do. But if you do nothing, and he's doomed, then you are in trouble. It's the most difficult thing to do. And in my experience of ecclesial life, if we had followed this faithfully, we would have had much less hurt and damage than what we have. Is that not true? If we had faithfully followed this. You see, brethren and sisters, I said to you, we're not toying around here. This is not stuff that you can say, oh, well, so. This is about eternal life. These are the principles which are going to be brought out at the judgment seat. If we have built our house upon a rock, this is the kind of thing we will have been found doing. If we've ignored it, then we're building our house upon sand. That's how important it is. Well then, again, Brother Sargent, I guess by now you've got the idea that I think this is a pretty good book. I thought that might sort of come to you. And I would suggest that if you feel inclined, that grabbing a copy, I don't think it's readily available nowadays, but there are copies around. So if you can get a copy of this book and read through it. It's a classic in our literature. Brother Sargent, what is peacemaking? The peacemaker is not one who plasters over a crack so that it does not show, nor one who takes the easy line of surface amiability. Oh, we're all good friends. when the cracks are wide open. Peace is made by the love which builds up. You remember the comments about peacemaking? Blessed are the peacemakers. What was their chief characteristic? Repairing the breach. Repairing the breach. They're builders, not wreckers. Builders. Repairer of the breach. Isaiah 58:12. What better synonym, he says, for a peacemaker. Well then, we come to the final part of this study, verses 25 and 26. This is about the other side of the coin. You see, in verses 22 to 24, what we have is us being the victim. We may be, of course, the perpetrator, but he's actually talking about us being the victim and responding to that. Let's hope we're not perpetrators. But if you're the victim, this is your responsibility. Go seek to heal the breach. But sometimes you're going to be in error. You're going to be the perpetrator. This is what he comes to in verse 25. Agree with thine adversary quickly whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. Verily I say unto thee, thou shalt by no means come out thence till thou hast paid the uttermost farthing. Now there is a difference, isn't there? Verily I say unto thee, he says, before it was, in verse 20, for I say unto you, verse 22, for I say unto you, verse 28, but I say unto you, verse 32, the same, verse 34, verse 39, verse 44. Why the difference? Why does he use the thee? Why do the translators use the thee? In verse 26, you may be aware of this fact, brethren and sisters, but consistently, it's invariable in both the Old and the New Testament that when the T words are used, thee, thou, thine, it is always singular. When the Y words are used, you, your, ye, it is always plural. And I can show you some fascinating usages in both Old and New. Says thee. Verily I say unto thee. Very personal. I say unto you, he's talking to a multitude. You could be involved in this, but when it is thee, it's you. I'm always pointing at Nathan, aren't I? He's quite innocent, I can assure you. But you got the point? See, when you are in error, and all of us from time to time are in error. And we may not have a court case against us, because what we have here is about a court case, as we're going to see. Agree, he says, with thine adversary, to be well disposed, of a peaceable spirit, the word means. Adversary, antidikos. It means an opponent in a lawsuit. So this fellow has got some kind of, he thinks he's got a prima facie case against you. He can go to the courts. He's got you, he thinks. So you may well be in the wrong. Agree with your opponent at law quickly, speedily, without delay. Why don't men agree quickly and without delay? Even when they are in the wrong. Why don't they do that? It seems stupid, doesn't it, to hold out against evidence that is incriminating. Why do we do that? Well, because of human pride. We just don't want to step down from our pedestal. We don't want people to think less of us. Well, I'll tell you something, brethren and sisters. When brethren who have offended come out into the open and say, I have done wrong, I have a higher regard for them in the wake of their sin than I had before. Because they have been prepared to do something that Ahithophel wasn't prepared to do, and many others after him were not prepared to do. Step down from the pedestal. Because they had a reputation, like Ahithophel, that when he spoke, it's like speaking to an angel of God. Step down and admit that you're wrong. And when you do, you'll have my respect. Because I know how human pride works. I can see it in number one. And it's hard. It's hard to say, I'm wrong. Especially if you've got a reputation. Isn't it, brethren? That's what he's saying. Be humble when in error. You won't lose anything. In fact, you will come up in the estimation of men, and more importantly, in the estimation of God. That's the principle involved here. Early submission is advisable when in error. Because the Lord warns, man's justice system is very unforgiving. God can forgive, can't he? He can forgive adultery and murder. Christ has said, if you are angry with your brother, the seed of murder is in your heart. Because if you had the chance, if you had a six gun on your hip, and you were in the Wild West in the 1860s, you would take it out and shoot him. Wouldn't you? Just today, if you did that, they'd clamp you in prison. So you don't do it. But anger, which breeds hatred and envy, and all the other things that come out of the heart of men, he says, anger is the seed of murder. What's going on in your heart is going to end up in some kind of action if you had the chance, the opportunity and the freedom to do it. That's what he's talking about. So it's here in the heart that we need to crush the human will, to crush human pride, and to step down from our own self-esteem. God can forgive. He forgave David of adultery and murder. And when Ahithophel comes forth from the grave, after dangling on his own rope, he's going to have to go through it the second time. Because he's hung himself. That's the principle of that. You're dealing with men, they're not like God. God can forgive, but men can and will be callous and unbalanced, unforgiving and unmerciful. It's good advice, isn't it, brethren and sisters? Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven.